call the next case of the day, 2011-50333, Kennison versus the City of San Antonio.
May it please the court. My name is Jackie Stroh, and I represent appellant the City of San Antonio. The underlying lawsuit arises from the city's demolition of property located at 332 East Myrtle Street in San Antonio prior to the owner, Paul Kennison, having received notice that the demolition would take place. This appeal arises out of summary judgment grants and denials made by the district court, in which the district court granted judgment in favor of the City of San Antonio on all of Kennison's claims, except for his claims for violations of procedural due process and of the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unreasonable seizures. And on those two claims, he granted summary judgment in favor of Kennison, following which there was a trial on damages, and the jury awarded Mr. Kennison $52,000 for the alleged loss to his property. The city has raised a number of issues on appeal. Concerning procedural due process, the city has explained.
Why didn't you look at the deed records? It just seems like such an obvious place to look.
I think that the evidence in the record, there's no evidence in the record that would show that at the time that any search would have been made on April 9th, which is when Alice Guajardo conducted her search of the relevant records, that it would have shown, in fact, that ownership had been transferred from DPAC Land Trust to Mr. Kennison. In fact, she inspected the property initially on April 8th, and it was on that following day, April 9th, when the actual sale took place. So there's no evidence that she would have discovered that the owner was, in fact, Mr. Kennison. And there's evidence that she took many other avenues to attempt to find who the owner was.
Once the prior owner said, hey, I've sold it, why didn't you go back to the deed records and look, since they didn't seem to know who the new owner was?
It's not in the evidence. It's just my understanding that they checked the Bexar County appraisal records not the deed records, but she did check the Bexar County appraisal records. She did check the City of San Antonio tax records. She did provide notice to DPAC Land Trust, who was listed as the current owner.
Which one would find out first, though? I mean, if you do a land transaction in San Antonio, you sign your deal, what happens first, filing the new title with the county deed records or notifying the tax authorities?
I don't know for sure. My guess would be the deed records and not the tax records, but I don't know, and that evidence is not in the record. But in addition to that information, she asked the DPAC Land Trust who the current owner was. They would not provide that information. There's evidence in Kennison's summary judgment attachments that she also, when she was at the property, asked someone who was at the property looking around the property, did they know who the owner was? They said they didn't have that information. So she did make efforts to obtain that information. And there's no evidence that any other search at the time she conducted a search would have revealed any additional information to her. We cited, with respect to that particular issue, that the city gave Kennison all the process he was due. The T case, which involved substantially similar circumstances, in which there was a land transfer that was recorded after the official in question conducted a record search, and the court held that there was indeed no due process violation.
And I haven't seen this in the briefing, so this is really just a question I have. Is it possible to do a Liz Pendens in a situation like this, where you're fixing to do some, you know, emergency repairs? Is that a viable option, or is it because you don't file litigation, there is nothing to file Liz Pendens? I mean, is there a similar procedure that would give notice to? Because let me back up and say, I understand the concept of constantly flipping the land to duck process, and I've seen it done as a state district judge, and I understand the concern. I don't see that that's really what happened here. And so I'm wondering, is there a way to give notice to these people by filing something in the deed records similar to a Liz Pendens, or is it just not such an animal?
I'm not really sure about that. It wasn't an issue that was ever raised by any party and not an issue that came up. I do know that, you know, in addition to all of these efforts made by Ms. Guajardo to give Kennison notice, that he actually did receive notice on the day of demolition, prior to the actual demolition of his property by a contractor who was on site. So I'm not sure what any notice that the city would have given.
Unless he's supposed to do that day, the demo crew's out there. I mean,
he's supposed to stand in front of the thing.
Well, I'm just pointing out that he did have actual notice prior to the actual demolition occurring.
But I mean, not in enough time, even probably to run down and get a TRO. You know, hire a lawyer and run down and all of that. I mean, I've had those kinds of TROs as a trial judge.
But I would note on that point that Kinnison doesn't claim of the lack of any additional pre-deprivation process. He has never argued that the city violated his procedural due process rights by denying him a pre-deprivation hearing. It's simply the notice
itself.
Well, I mean,
yeah, he had to have the notice in order to go get the hearing and whatever else.
Well, he was deprived of pre-deprivation hearing, though.
But he's not complaining of that. But he did not receive a pre-deprivation hearing, but he's not complaining of that. But our backup argument, and the one that we devote more of the briefing to, is the argument that he's not entitled to pre-deprivation notice
at
or
all.
Process
no,
at
I,
all.
I get that, and it's a troubling concept to me, because the problem I have with this case, and I'm not sure it rises to the level of arbitrariness, which I know is a high
standard.
But, I mean, this building looks a whole lot like the buildings that I used to spend months with the city coming in. This was in Dallas, but the city coming in with these pictures, and I grant this injunction that makes the owner fix it, and then they come back after 30 days and they haven't done it, and I grant another injunction, and there's these fines, and this would go on for months before the thing was finally demolished and a lien put on it by the city. And this looks a lot like that. Now, I'm not saying that's arbitrary. I'm just questioning, are we going to suddenly have San Antonio going in, bulldozing most of the houses in
there's no evidence of that in the record at all.
Because there's a lot of houses that you and I wouldn't really be pleased to live in that people live in honorably that aren't real nice looking.
Well,
and I'm very troubled by just going in and bulldozing it on a few days' decision.
It's not a matter of a house that is not nice to live in. The house was wholly uninhabitable.
Well, so were all these houses in Dallas that I'm granting these injunctions. Why was I wasting all this time for months with these injunctions if they could just go bulldoze the thing without my help?
The whole standard as set forth in federal case law is, can the official, when they go to the property, can they make a determination that the property itself prevents an imminent threat to life, safety, and or property? And if they can make that decision, and that decision is reasonable and is not arbitrary, then the courts are required to give deference to that determination, and there is no pre-deprivation notice or hearing required.
Why was the policy not complied with?
What policy?
The policy to do the demolition within 72 hours.
It was complied with. I know that opposing counsel makes the argument that there was no compliance with that. He argued that...
I thought it took 9 days.
It did from the initial inspection of Guajardo, but that is not the way the statute reads. The statute reads a demolition of 72 hours from the time that the Director of Development Services or another official listed in the very first line of the ordinance concurs in the demolition. The demolition took place within 72 hours of the concurrence.
Of the concurrence, and so the policy was complied with.
It was complied with, and not only that.
Is there even an argument that it wasn't?
He did make an argument that it wasn't, and the district court rejected that argument, and he does not challenge that on appeal. He made a claim with respect to the violation of the ordinance itself, raised a cause of action. The district court, in rejecting that cause of action, said that despite his arguments that the ordinance was not complied with, that in the particulars that he argued, one of which was the 72-hour requirement, that in fact the city did comply with that requirement because the demolition took place within 72 hours of the concurrence of the director of the Department of Development Services. So,
okay. Does it matter at all that the municipal code has been amended, and does this have anything to do with this case?
It has nothing to do with this case, and it doesn't matter at all. The demolition occurred under the old ordinance.
Could it happen under the new ordinance today? Would it happen like this?
It could happen like this under the new ordinance. The new ordinance does require the posting of a placard at the property being demolished, but it doesn't
So that would have given him notice if somebody to call before it got down to the wire.
But it would be the same exact situation that we have here because the contractor did in fact call him prior to demolition and inform him that the property was being demolished. It doesn't say prior to demolition.
How come the contractor could find him but the inspector can't?
Well, I assume because Kinnison hired the contractor.
Okay, so the contractor calling him to say they're there.
Yes.
But if he would have been there on the property, then he might have seen it and driven by or something.
But it doesn't say when the placard has to be posted, and in any event, the new ordinance doesn't have anything to do with this case. The case is governed by the old ordinance.
Does the Texas Supreme Court's decisions in this area that have been in the past few months have anything to do with this? You know, they've made it more difficult to do these warrant kind of things and these nuisance property situations.
The Texas Supreme Court?
Yes, does that have any bearing on
it? It doesn't have any bearing. The Stewart case, I think you're referring to, had to do with a nuisance finding. There the court held that where someone appealed the administrative finding of nuisance, that it would not be entitled to substantial deference, but it was a nuisance finding, not a finding of imminent threat to safety property, to life, safety, and or property. And in any event, the Texas Supreme Court, I just want to make this point really quickly, the Texas Supreme Court made very clear that that decision was under the Texas Constitution and, in fact, rejected any federal authorities as not binding because it was not making its decision under the federal Constitution.
And this lawsuit
solely under the federal Constitution.
Okay. And the federal Constitution, among other things, is a protector of individual rights against the government. I think it's very fundamental. And one very fundamental individual right is your right to own property, do with it as you wish. Now, that's counterbalanced by, you know, public safety and those kinds of things. I get that. The problem I have is getting back to this imminent danger idea. I understand the case where something was going to fall over on a daycare or something like that, that was an imminent danger. The problem I have with this place is, you know, no, it's not a place you want to live or have anybody live.
You couldn't
understand that.
You couldn't live.
Okay, well, you'd be amazed where people live.
You couldn't live in this.
And that's part of the problem sometimes with these dilapidated houses is people do live in them, and they should, and in all of that, and I get all of that. So I'm not saying this is some great place. The sad thing is Kinnison was going to, fix it, and that's kind of what we would have liked to see him do. And it was cut short by this whole situation. But my point is more, so you have a dilapidated house that's not fit for human habitability. What is so imminent about the danger that requires us to rush out on 72 hours to start demolishing the thing before we can have time to look at the deed records? That, to me, is the fundamental question here.
And if I could just point the court to the case law that we've cited in our brief, I think, Judge Haynes, you're approaching the question from the wrong perspective. You're approaching it almost as if the district court had some sort of de novo review over the question of
No, I know it's an arbitrary standard. I'm asking you a question I'd like an answer to under any standard. What is so darn imminent? That's my question. Then I can judge whether it's arbitrary what you did.
Well, what Guajardo noted in her report was that the structure had fire damage to approximately 40% of the structure. It was listing. The foundation itself was listing. There were rotted members in the floors, the walls, and the ceilings. There were holes in the floors, the walls, and the ceilings. If you look at the pictures of the house, the roof itself, which is a metal roof, is rusted and itself is listing, with one side obviously much closer to the ground than the other. There's evidence of vagrancy, not only by the fire, which of course poses a danger, but by graffiti on the property as well. Under those circumstances, certainly she was reasonable in assessing that this property posed an imminent threat to life, safety, and or property. Vagrants could come in, set fires, cause a fire to this home, cause a fire to neighboring property. The foundation was listing and was supported by pillars were listing and rotted.
I can set fire in my house and it might cause a fire next door, and I hope nobody's going to demolish my house, and it's a perfectly nice house.
But that's not what we're talking about
here. So, I mean,
that would be arbitrary. This is not arbitrary. I mean, we're talking about a property that's wholly unsecured, that has access through the walls. I mean, they're missing door. I mean, anyone can go on the property. The question here is, was she reasonable?
But where's the line? Because we do have a lot of houses out in the world, and particularly in a metropolitan area like San Antonio, that are, you know, unimpressive, let's just say. What is the line between just a house that's unimpressive and a house that's in imminent danger that's not, you know, and that's how we judge arbitrariness. Is there a line? Is there a standard? What is the line?
The line and the standard is, was it reasonable and did it lack any arbitrary nature to it? Not only did Guajardo look at this property, I mean, there's evidence in the record that she made an initial assessment that the property constituted, warranted an emergency demolition. She then contacted the senior building inspector for the city of San Antonio, who then went out independently and made assessments of all these various structures. Concurred with her assessment, they got concurrences from two other city employees. All of that evidence is in the record.
You saved some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Tyler Rutherford for Chance Kennison. Here's an imminent danger. City code inspector, this is Officer Rodriguez. We've got a 20-story building with a fire escape that's falling off, and it's about to fall onto a daycare. Okay, we're on it. Lights are blaring, sirens are screaming. They run out there. They cordon off the area. They take the fire escape down. That's an imminent danger, okay? Not a broken window in a building. The city would have you believe that anytime there's a broken window or a doorway that's open, they can go in and without any notice whatsoever, declare it an imminent danger and destroy the building without any notice to the
property. Okay, where's your line? I mean, other than the daycare, which we all agree on,
right.
What, you know, she's got a very good point. The standard of review of this whole situation is very favorable to the city. You're suing a city, and so there's a lot of deference to the city, and particularly when we're talking about a federal government coming in and interfering with local government. So I get that. So tell me what your line is that is different from their line.
Sure. Here's my line. You know, this great deference standard, I have found that line of reasoning and that chain of thought in a lot of low-level federal appendix judicial murmurings, you know, the bankruptcy court of Guam, okay? But I haven't seen a lot of that in traditional upper-level circuit court reasons. In fact, and I cited to the court the Dallas versus Heather case, that just came out January 16th of this year, and there the Texas Supreme Court, they were reviewing whether or not an administrative finding had some sort of res judicata effect. And there the court said, no, you know, these are constitutional analyses that we're making here. We are not going to give agency decisions this sort of preclusive effect. We are going to Monday morning quarterback them because that's our job.
Was that under the Texas Constitution or the United States?
It was the Texas Constitution, Your Honor. But
and you haven't appealed the findings on the Texas constitutional claims in this case.
No, we did not appeal those. The point is that if you look at the language in the case, it's talking about basic general Constitution with a capital C.
Okay,
notions.
Let me ask you this. You said the, you know, we're not going to follow the bankruptcy court of Guam. Where is your high-level case that says the standard is something other than arbitrary, you know, was the decision arbitrary and a somewhat deferential standard?
Well,
so where's this high-level decision that's better than Guam?
Right. Well, what I have besides the Texas Supreme Court case, I don't have anything I can't give you. The Ninth Circuit said this. I can't give you that. But what I can give you is that the judge, even if you use the arbitrary standard, the judge was so convinced that 9 days had elapsed and the city did not abate the nuisance, that was clearly arbitrary. And the city complains, oh, well, that's only one piece of evidence. Well, that piece of evidence is like whacking somebody in the head with a hammer. I mean, it is very conclusive, and I think...
If it wasn't imminent enough that it required something to be done within the 9 days, then it isn't imminent enough to obviate notice, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what the judge said. You know, he said, look, city, if you thought this is so completely imminent, you know, and you can just, you know, truncate the Constitution, why did you wait 9 days to do something about it? You know, that's pretty damning evidence.
How is there deliberate indifference by the city?
I'm sorry?
I'm concerned about discretionary acts of the inspector. Even if the inspector's wrong and it really wasn't an imminent danger, and you're right and it should have been, the facts show that it wasn't, why is the city liable?
Well, because that's what the Constitution says. If not only was their decision wrong, okay, Guajardo was wrong. They were arbitrarily wrong.
But yeah. The ordinance is okay, though, right? The ordinance is constitutional. So if they carried out the law improperly, then why is the city responsible?
Well, I don't. Number one, I don't think that the law is constitutional.
Counsel, everything you've said so far sounds like vicarious liability to me. And there is no vicarious liability under Section 1983 for the city.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know how to respond to that. Vicarious liability was not raised by the appellant or the appellee. The city acts through its officers, its agents.
Have to show that it's linked to a policy or custom of the city that caused it.
6-175
But the policy is not, the policy itself is not in question. There's nothing wrong with the policy that's unconstitutional. So you have to show, so that the city is not vicariously liable, you have to show that it's either the policy itself that is the constitutionally violated, or it has to be that has to be the way that they always do it, that, and they've got a pattern in practice, that you can't just have an isolated incident that somebody did that showed poor judgment and then say that's a constitutional violation under 1983 against the city.
Well, Your Honor, the vicarious liability issue was not one that was raised or briefed by any party, but this litigant is not agreeing that the 6-175 is constitutional as drafted. In fact, they revised it.
Counsel, that's not an affirmative defense. You've got to prove the 1983 cause of action under the Supreme Court holdings of the liability. The limited liability of a municipal corporation has to be policy or pattern, or the act of a policymaker. Now, you don't have it in this case.
Well, I would disagree, respectfully disagree with Your Honor, in that we have 6-175, which is what the officer was operating under.
Okay, but agree.
Maybe I'm missing it, but that's what I see.
The problem that I think my colleagues are pointing out is that you agree that if that staircase or whatever, the fire escape is about to fall on the daycare, they could swoop in and deal with that.
Well, that's what
this policy gives them the right to do. What you're disagreeing with, and I think there's some basis to disagree with, is whether this was in fact imminent. But if it wasn't imminent, then these guys were off on some lark, then you have the problem of municipal liability for a lark. That's, I think, what they're focusing in on.
Well, the problem is, I guess,
that's why these cases are hard to win for
the problem is that leads you into, you know, a catch-22. You can't do it, and there's no remedy for any kind of violation. I think that 6-175 is, you know, wasn't cross-appealed, but we argued, you know, in the lower court that it was unconstitutionally vague. Those claims got dismissed. The city's amended the ordinance, so I think that goes to show that, yes, there is some difficulty and there are issues, constitutional-level issues, with this ordinance. I'll try to satisfy your concerns regarding that, but it's the courts that are the last bastion of, you know, protecting property owners like Chance Kennison against overzealous, arbitrary actions by the city of San Antonio or city actors.
Right, but even if we agree with you that it was overzealous in this case, we have to have a constitutional hook that you have to bring forward to hold the city liable.
Well, you know, these issues were never raised by the city in the trial court, and so, you know, they're sort of catching me off guard here. I mean, the city never raised vicarious liability issues in its motion for summary judgment. Those were never raised. Those were never adjudicated upon. And so, you know, you catch me off guard when you raised them here, and I just haven't, those weren't briefed. Those weren't,
Position that they've somehow been waived?
Well, yeah, I guess if you didn't raise it in your summary judgment or assert it as a defense, you know, an affirmative defense, and move on it, then I guess it has been waived. I guess there is some sort of waiver. I can continue. Well, I guess I should start from the beginning. I haven't even started the beginning of my argument. I had 11 points that I wanted to make, but obviously I don't think I'm enough time to make 11 points. But again, I think the court has primary point that I want to make is, and the court's focused in on that, is, you know, these are very limited exceptions to constitutional notice. They must be truly unusual, and again, that I think is what the court focused on. Here's some examples. Risk of explosion, demolition of a house to stop a spreading fire. You know, I think the Great Chicago Fire, that's the kind of thing I think of. The city complains that the trial court focused on the Houston versus Crabb. It was a Texas Supreme Court case that the day of requirement was somehow inappropriately used by the trial court, because that is not, I guess, sort of a federal constitutional measure of conduct. And I argued in my brief that what that is that's basically just a functional equivalent of an imminent danger analysis. And again, I would point to the city's own code, which says that they have 72 hours to do this stuff. And I disagree with opposing counsel regarding whether or not the 72-hour requirement was complied with, because it says that I'm reading right from the ordinance: the foregoing emergency abatement action shall be executed not later than 72 weekday hours after the official views the subject building or structure. And Guajardo was an official, a code enforcement officer, that first viewed the building, and they waited nine. They violated their own ordinance. Why else would they have the 72-hour requirement in there if there was no imminent danger analysis, or they were concerned about that? And I think an important point I want to make is that I don't even think we get to the question of whether or not chance was. Should have been given notice if we find that it's our position. If this was an imminent danger, there would be no need for them to go digging through deed records to try and find out who he is, because obviously there wouldn't have been time. They needed to do something then. But in the court, you know, hey, you took 9 days from the time you inspected it to the time you knocked it down. What was the delay? Well, at that, when you get to the 9-day delay at that point, that's when the court's like, well, okay, you had 9 days. What'd you do to try and find out who he was? And you know, the city tries to explain away all of this this time period with all this busy work that it had to do to comply with the ordinance. Well, if you look at the ordinance, there is none of that busy work requirements that they say that they have to do, like notifying.
It's certainly not spending a lot of time trying to find your client. It's busy work, is it?
Well, no, and they could have done that. They didn't do a whole lot of that.
That was a friendly question.
Yeah, right. Thank you, Judge. I'll take all the friendly questions I can get. They could have done that, but you know what they do in their affidavit is. Guajardo says, well, I spent 30 minutes sharpening my pencil to write on my report, and then I looked up the phone number of the city councilman.
Well, is there any evidence? Okay, look, is there any evidence that looking at the deed record on April 9 would have revealed Kinnison?
He testified, or it's in his affidavit, that he recorded his deed the day before, okay? In
the
Bear
day
County,
before what?
I'm sorry, with the Bear County clerk.
No,
Bear County clerk.
I'm sorry, you said the day before. The day before what?
The day before Guajardo's first inspection.
Okay.
And, you know, remember, we still got 9 days out where they could have made another search to find out where he is. Instead, Cuellar, the foundation contractor who Chance hires to go out to fix the place, right, calls him and says, hey, we're demolishing the building. And the city wants to say, well, that's all they needed, you know.
Now, I don't think that they're saying they don't need, you don't need anything.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, I don't think they're really, I mean, although she made the argument, I mean, I think it's a bit ridiculous when the demolition crew's out there, you're not going to even have time to go find
a
judge.
Hey, we're demolishing it. Bang.
Yeah. I don't think she's saying that if you have to give notice, giving notice as you lower the boom is particularly sufficient.
Right.
She's just saying they don't have to give notice.
Well, and I would agree if it was an imminent danger. But, you know, again, the 9 days, the trial court's like, 9 days? That, you know, that's arbitrary. That's unreasonable. If you're going to wait that long, let's give them some notice. And that's
are
the point that I
want to. Are you challenging that you didn't get a hearing?
Yeah, yes, we are. I mean, obviously, you don't want to just notice and.
I know. Did you challenge that on appeal? The other side said that you're not challenging that and that you waived that issue or left that behind.
No, I didn't waive.
Where is that? Is that in your brief that you're challenging that you didn't get a pre-deprivation of property hearing?
No, that's in our petition. That's in our plaintiff's complaint.
Is it in your appeal to this court?
We didn't file any cross points. There are no cross points. But, I mean, that's still an issue that's alive and well in the appeal because it is raised and preserved in the complaint that was ruled on by the motion of the cross motions for summary judgment.
Well, if you'd had a notice, you wouldn't have had to rely on San Antonio to give you some administrative hearing. You could have run down to the, you know, district court, Bexar County, and tried to get a TRO.
Yeah, in
fact,
that's
what people do. Whatever you are supposed to do, I know that's what they do.
If you got time.
Because I would get those TROs always at an inconvenient time.
Yeah, but that's, you know, obviously if you not if you get a call from your foundation contractor.
No, and I don't think you had time to get a TRO. I've spotted you that. But what I'm saying is, had they told you, you know, on April 9th, hey, we're fixing to demolish you tomorrow, you would have had time. Whether they gave you an administrative hearing or not, you would have had time to run down to a district court and try to get a TRO.
Could be. I mean, you know, there's obviously vagaries of, you know. What time is it? Is there a lawyer? You know, that possibly, yes. But I would think that if it was not an imminent danger and maybe just a nuisance, the appropriate remedy would be, you know, we have the DSDB board, the other rep, which I think that this case should have gone through. It should have gone through the danger structure determination board or whatever, where you get some sort of administrative hearing. And then now the Texas Supreme Court says you also get judicial review of that, okay? Which, and I think that again carries over and infects this great deference argument that the city tries to make.
You make light of this, but the point is that while I waxed eloquent on the importance of the U.S. Constitution protecting individual rights, there's also a very fundamental notion of state sovereignty and that states take care of their own people to a large extent, as the Texas Supreme Court has done in Stewart, very admirably, under their own constitution, so we don't have to get involved. So a federal constitutional violation that gives rise to a Section 1983 isn't just, you know, anything that upsets anybody. It's a fairly difficult thing to do because of the concern of federal versus state and then local governments.
Do you have state claims pending anywhere now?
No, Your Honor, they were all dismissed by the trial court. But back to Judge Haynes, I understand. I mean, you guys are always balancing, you know, when you're doing constitutional analysis, you're always doing a balancing test. There's always competing needs. But here, even if you use the great deference standard, the court's like, man, you guys, 9 days? It shows to the court it was overwhelmingly arbitrary. It was so much so that that Judge Rodriguez felt that we don't. There's no trial here. This is arbitrary. You guys waited 9 days. Let's try the issue on damages and get this case down the road. And I think that's what he did. Again, I mentioned that the ordinance has been amended. We talked about the great deference. Argument again, you know, even if you use that standard, it is still fails to meet that. And, you know, as far as the deed records, and I don't know if I mentioned this, but when you go file your deed record, or, you know, go file a deed with the Bexar County clerk, they scan the thing, and they give it back to you, and it goes in their database. And checking tax records, you know, if you're, the tax collector, he's going through the deed records himself to get that information for his tax roll. So obviously there's going to be a lag.
It's better to check the deed records.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not... Yes. Our, and Bexar County, the, our deed records, there. Anybody who's got an internet computer with internet, you can just type in an address, and get the name of the deed. And that.
Well, I mean, hopefully, however we come out here, they've learned the value of deed records.
I hope. I would hope so.
Yeah.
I would really hope so. I mean, they amended the ordinance.
All right. Thank you. So something good came.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mrs. Stroh, I have a message for the city attorney of San Antonio with respect.
Right.
Supreme Court of the United States 30 years ago wrote Monell versus the City of New York Society. Fifth Circuit has held it 30, 40, 50 times. Why do we have to listen to arbitrariness? Why do we have to listen to the problem of what happened out there that destroyed that race when the only party to this suit is the City of San Antonio? And all you need to do is cite Monell, period.
Well, Your Honor, I would note that Monell was raised in the motion for JMOL. The court did address it specifically on page 7 of its order. It says the city argues that plaintiff failed to make any showing of a policymaker or official policy as required.
I understand. That's helping you on waiver. You've got a lot of argument before Judge Rodriguez, who is an excellent judge, and the Fifth Circuit. Yeah. Your brief here.
Yeah, where is it here?
Yeah, I went through your brief here while we're sitting here.
Yeah.
It's not in your brief.
It's not in the brief.
Can we find for you on Monell, which is the straightforward theory for the city in this case, when it's not in your appellate brief? I'm shocked, frankly, that a government entity would not raise Monell under the facts here in their brief before us. Can we find for you? Is there some case that would allow us?
I think you
or
can.
You waived it.
I think you can find for us in the sense that we have challenged the summary judgment that was granted in favor of Kinnison on his claims, and given that, as Judge Reevely pointed out, it's not an affirmative defense, given that it's part of his claim and he did not make that showing, then yes, the court could reverse the summary judgment granted in favor of Kinnison on that.
But do you have
grounds.
No obligation to make the argument timely to the district court, which you didn't because JMO was
late.
Not timely, and secondly to us? I mean,
or do
yeah,
you win
if
anyway?
We were talking straight up, we're in the district court right now, straight up on a summary judgment, you're coming and saying they haven't met their burden, fine. But now we are a few degrees removed from that, and you still haven't made the argument. It's being made for you by very able judges here. Can we not find a waiver then and say, all right, you want to talk arbitrariness? Let's talk it.
You could, and really the focus of our brief is the arbitrariness standard.
Right. So you're not really raising respondeat superior and vicarious liability under Monell and its progeny before us today, are you?
No. I'm arguing the arbitrariness standard. And the court, when you look at the decisions that were decided, we're not relying on a district court decision by Guam. I mean, if you look at the cases that are cited in our case, they are second.
Guam is a very fine place.
It is, but we're not talking about just district court decisions. We're talking about decisions from the Second Circuit, the Third Circuit, and the like. We've quoted extensively from a decision
okay,
from the Second Circuit.
Never mind where the standard comes from. We spot the arbitrariness standard. What is your response? I understand you're saying the final guy to sign off on it was within the 72 hours, but what is your response to just the basic premise that if you can take 9 days to fix it, it ain't imminent?
And we have cited cases in our brief addressing that particular point as well. There is a case that's cited in our brief that involved a delay of, I believe, 8 days, and the court nevertheless held as a matter of law that discretion was due. The city or the official's determination that emergency circumstances existed that obviated the need for pre-deprivation notice and a hearing. We've cited other cases as well, and I would, if I could just read briefly from this quote in the Second Circuit case, because it really speaks to all of these issues. It says, this somewhat deferential standards find strong support in policy considerations. The law should not discourage officials from taking prompt action to ensure public safety. By subjecting a decision to invoke an emergency procedure to an exacting hindsight analysis, where every mistake, even if made in good faith, becomes a constitutional violation, we encourage delay and thereby potentially increase the public's exposure to dangerous conditions. This quandary is exactly what these emergency procedures are designed to prevent and is the primary reason they are constitutionally acceptable.
Can you tell me that, what's the name of that case?
That's the Catanzaro case. It's cited in our brief, and in fact, this exact quote appears in our brief. That case and other cases also note that neither perfection nor near perfection is the standard, that city officials can make mistakes, that they don't have to be structural engineers. They don't have to have engineering experience when making these determinations. It's whether they made, based on the information that was before them at the time, a reasonable call that the particular property before them presented an imminent threat. And under this record, they did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This case is submitted.